Blog Talk Radio.
And good afternoon, listeners. This is Military Monday from Fairfax, Virginia, where it's a beautiful day with puffy clouds. Actually, a rather nice fall day. And today we're going to have a little chat about... Hang on a second. We are having a small technical problem. Okay, much better. Today we are going to go and talk a little bit about something Americans rarely think about, strategy, which is to say, how do you go and be a superpower like the United States and make your way in an ever-changing, ever more complex, and ever less stable world? What do I mean by that? Well, consider that throughout the 20th century, much of it, we had a fight with, or at least a beef, with another superpower nation state, the Soviet Union. They went and opposed us. We opposed them. And each of us had a national strategy. We had allies. We had doctrines. And we had basic concepts. Ours was to contain the Soviet Union and communism. And in 1989, much to our surprise and wonderment, we won. This long, cold containment strategy actually worked. But since the end of the Soviet Union in 1991, and in the decades since, we have not really had a national strategy. And as a result, we have kind of stumbled from crisis to crisis, war to war, administration to administration, with no central theme for how America is to proceed into the new millennium and the 21st century. Now, it's worth noting that our first real national strategy was not something thought up by the national leadership. It did not come out of the White House or the departments of the Navy or War. It came from a privately published book by a Navy captain by the name of Alfred Thayer Mahan, and it was a little book called The Influence of Sea Power Upon History, and it changed the world. And we are going to be talking today with a gentleman, a naval officer in his own right, who more than a century later thinks that we should go back to what Mahan said in The Influence of Sea Power Upon History, and perhaps use some of the guiding principles put forth in that book to create a new national strategy for America in the 21st century. Our guest today is Lieutenant Commander Benjamin F. Armstrong, U.S. Navy. He works in the office of the Secretary of the Navy, Ray Mabies. He's obviously had a rather busy week this past week, but he's been kind enough to come on with us today. And he's going to talk to us over the next hour about strategy, America, and our future. Are you there, Commander?
Yeah, John. Thank you so much for having me on Military Mondays with you.
I really appreciate you coming on. And let's start by going and asking a couple of simple questions that may not have such simple answers. Who was...
Well, if I could, John, just to begin...
Sure.
I would like, after you gave a brief comment on my bio there, I do need to make sure you and all of our listeners understand that I put this book together and have done my writing and my historical research in my private capacity. I am not here today as a naval officer. I'm here today as a historian. So anything that I say should not be construed as a formal or official position of the Department of the Navy, the Department of Defense, or any government agency. These are my private opinions, all on my own.
Perfectly reasonable. And let's start with that. I'm going to start with a simple question that may not have the simplest of answers. Who was Captain Alfred Thayer Mahan? When was he? And what was his point of view?
So Alfred Thayer Mahan was born before the Civil War in 1840 on the banks of the Hudson River up at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. His father, Dennis Mahan, was a noted instructor in military engineering and strategy, who also became the dean at West Point later on in his career. So as military children sometimes tend to do, he rebelled against his father's plans for his life in the most dramatic way he could think of, and that was as the son of an Army officer, he joined the Navy. He had studied law at Columbia for a little bit over a year before he used some of his father's contacts in government to get himself an appointment to the Naval Academy at Annapolis. And then he went on to serve as a junior officer in the Civil War and rose through the ranks to command the U.S. Navy's European flagship there on the European Squadron, which today would kind of be the equivalent of Sixth Fleet's flagship. But it's not really the naval officer, Mahan, his record at sea, that most people are drawn to or their attention's drawn to. Instead, it started about his time as an instructor at the Naval Academy in the 1870s, when he also became one of the earliest presidents of the U.S. Naval Institute. And he started writing about what it means to be a naval officer professionally, as well as the history of navies and about strategy. And he went on later in his career to be one of the very first members of the faculty at the Naval War College, which was our country's first war college. And there he began kind of writing and thinking about strategy and international affairs. And from then through his retirement until his death in 1914, he kind of became recognized as one of the world's preeminent strategic thinkers at that time.
Now, let's put that in context. People like you and I study classic strategic thinking through the books and writings of people like Sun Tzu, great Chinese thinker who wrote The Art of War, von Clausewitz, the French general Jomini. How does Mahan stack up against them, and how does he fit into that pantheon of strategic thinkers?
So Mahan is commonly viewed as the first American who has challenged that group, if you will, to join that group of strategic thinkers that you just listed there. Historian John Sumita, who teaches up at the University of Maryland, wrote a book a couple years ago that he entitled Inventing Grand Strategy and Teaching Command, and it was all about the writings of Mahan. And Sumita had put forward that thesis that he was the inventor of the very idea of national grand strategy. Within the larger pantheon of strategic thinkers that you just listed there, when it comes to naval affairs, Mahan is the great thinker. The only other person who would be listed probably as a peer of his would be Julian Corbett, who came to us from the United Kingdom, also who was a bit of a naval historian like Mahan was. So those are the two kind of great naval thinkers if you go back to classical naval strategy. There are many others. There are others that wrote similar time periods, and even a few that wrote a little bit before Mahan. But his book, The Influence of Sea Power Upon History, was a worldwide bestseller before the turn of the last century, and he was really the first naval strategist to achieve that kind of recognition.
Now, when we say bestseller, we're talking in terms of his time, of a book that was translated into dozens of languages, sold thousands and thousands of copies, and was read by what kind of people? Talk about some of the people who read this book and got it and were influenced by it.
Well, so the most popular place initially when the book was released was in Great Britain. And the book did very well. The Influence of Sea Power Upon History did very well in Great Britain. It probably shouldn't surprise us a whole heck of a lot because, in reality, the book is a history of the Royal Navy and why Great Britain and the Royal Navy became such a great power. So the fact that they liked the fact that someone was showing how great they were probably shouldn't surprise us a whole heck of a lot. But it wasn't just in Great Britain that it became popular. One of the earliest reviewers of the book was a young recent graduate of college named Theodore Roosevelt, who had completed a book of his own on the Naval War of 1812, which to this day is considered one of the classic histories of that war. And Teddy Roosevelt reviewed Mahan's book for a number of journals, and he considered it one of the greatest pieces of naval literature to have been written to that point. And it wasn't just here in the United States or in the Anglo world that he was popular. The book was translated into Japanese and circulated within the Japanese fleet. The Kaiser Wilhelm, had it translated into German and made sure that it went into all of the wardrooms of the ships in his navy. So, like you said, it was a worldwide phenomenon.
And as a privately published work, this thing had huge influence on the development of strategies and navies for a generation after it was published, correct?
That's absolutely right. The most military strategy that had been written to that point generally had a continentalist feel. It was a land power feel. And you listed Clausewitz and Jomini as kind of two of the archetypes of that. Mahan talked about the idea that it was sea power and navies that are truly what guided the interaction between nations on a global scale, not just worrying about your neighbors, not just worrying about those that share a continent with you, but starting to think globally for the first time. And it really kind of meshed well with what was happening in the world around the turn of the last century, which is when the first real bout of globalization started. You know, we talk today about the idea that the economy that we have today, that the interconnectedness that information technology creates for us and the internet, how this is all new and different and amazing, and we have globalization, and Tom Friedman will tell you that the world is flat. All of these things were also happening at the turn of the last century. To them, instead of the internet, it was underwater telegraph cables that allowed you to communicate with other continents near instantaneously. And it was the introduction of steam power, which meant your sails on your ships didn't dictate how fast you got somewhere. You could just head straight there under steam power. So commerce moved faster, communication moved faster. All those things we talk about today were happening then too. So Mahan's idea of thinking globally, it really fit the time.
And a lot of nations were coming into their own as commercial, military, and power centers. The United States had this notion of manifest destiny, not an unusual thing given the events of the 20th century that followed, correct?
Yeah, I think that it's important to point out who Mahan was writing for in terms of his domestic audience. At the time, the United States was kind of a sixth-rate power. It did not have, on a global level, very much influence. You know, the Civil War, the Mexican War, the War of 1812, they were all here in the United States or in our neighbors' countries. And those were the big conflicts that we had fought after the founding of our nation. And so the idea that the United States was going to enter this global space was kind of a new one. Manifest destiny had, at this point, you know, after the Civil Wars, we closed in on the end of the century there, manifest destiny was running out. You know, we'd made it all the way to the coast. The borders with Canada and with Mexico had been pretty much solidified in the years after the Civil War. And so if we were going to expand, if the United States was going to expand its influence, it was going to have to be beyond our shores.
And this included places like Latin America, the Far East, places where government was uncertain, tribal sorts of governments ruled. And there were aging and, in some cases, crumbling empires like that of Spain, correct?
Yeah, that's true and accurate. Mahan was, he understood the naval history of the period, and especially the U.S. Navy, and he knew that in those places, Latin America or the Pacific in Asia, East Asia, the U.S. Navy had been there for almost a century at that point. You know, our Navy's first voyage to the Pacific and to Asia was in 1800 when Preble took the Essex during the Quasi War all the way to Sumatra, to the island of Sumatra, in order to protect American shipping that was in the Pacific in 1800. So he knew that this history had existed. What Mahan was really interested in was not necessarily the operations of navies in these places, but the idea of what a fleet could do and what a fleet could be to its nation and to the power of that nation as a great power. Because the United States at this point, when he started writing, really was not considered a great power. It was not on the same level as England or Germany or even Spain at that point. It wasn't until the naval building that in part was kind of inspired by Mahan's writing had created a fleet in which we could win the Spanish-American War that the United States stepped forward onto the world stage as a potential great power.
And for those interested in having a word with myself or with Commander Armstrong, please feel free to call in. Our call-in number is area code 347-945-7246. Again, that's area code 347-945-7246. Commander, let's talk a little bit about what things Mahan said in his book. What were the big ideas that he really was putting forth as he showed the influence of what the Royal Navy had done in their history since the Elizabethan era?
One of the central elements of Mahan's starting thesis of sea power is basically that commerce is king. That the interaction between nations, a lot of it, a great deal of it, is dictated by economics and commerce. And in a world where trade is global, it is the protection of your nation's commerce that is central to your status as a power. If other nations can interdict your commerce, if other nations can stop you from trading, they can stop supplies from coming to your country or your goods from getting out, then you're going to have a really hard time economically, and you're going to have a hard time either establishing yourself as a power or remaining a power. So having a navy in order to defend that commerce is at the very core of what Mahan wrote about in The Influence of Sea Power Upon History. Now, what I've done in my book, 21st Century Mahan, is to kind of take a step beyond that. Because, lots of people have read The Influence of Sea Power Upon History, or those of us that are officers have been taught about it, or naval historians are interested in it. And a lot of folks read that book thinking, okay, I've read it, and now I know Mahan. The problem is, it's like any prolific author. One book cannot sum up all of the work that they've ever done, especially the second book they published when they were relatively young. And so what I've done is gone and looked for his other writings, because he wrote his first published article was in the 1870s, and he wrote all the way up to his death in 1914. And in that time, he wrote dozens and dozens of articles and almost two dozen books. It was almost 300 articles when you include op-eds and things like that. So what I tried to do was go and look for other things that Mahan wrote about that might help officers, thinkers, historians, strategists in the 21st century learn about these other things that he talked about.
Tell us a little more about the background of this thin little volume that you've done, 21st Century Mahan for U.S. Naval Institute. There's no secret, of course, why you probably went to Naval Institute. It's, Mahan's practically on their masthead, and it's certainly inscribed in the building all over the Naval Academy. But what motivated you in particular to want to try and bring Mahan and make him relevant in the present day?
Well, Mahan was one of the very first presidents of the U.S. Naval Institute, and during his tenure as the head of the gunnery department in Annapolis, when he was a commander in the 1870s, that's when he was actually the president of the Institute and led that organization. So, yeah, it makes complete sense that that the Naval Institute Press would be printing this book. Me personally, I several years ago studied for my master's degree in military history, and one of the seminar courses that I took was a class on military thought and theory. And so we went through all of those greats that you listed, you know, Clausewitz, Shinza, Jomini, and we went through Mahan and Corbett. And being, you know, a good naval officer, I decided to write my final paper for that seminar on the comparisons between Mahan and Corbett. And I'll be honest, it probably wasn't that good of a paper, and it kind of trotted out a lot of the trite, cliched comparisons between the two. And my professor let me know that they were kind of cliched comparisons, and I didn't do a particularly good job of it. And from that moment, I kind of came to that realization that, okay, reading the one book, you know, by each of them, The Influence of Sea Power Upon History in Mahan's case, or Some Principles of Maritime Strategy in Corbett's case, you can't know what someone really thought just by reading the one book. And so that kind of launched me off over the course of a number of years to slowly but surely start working my way through some of the canon that is Mahan's work. During that time, I did also read that John Sumita book, Inventing Grand Strategy and Teaching Command, in which I first ran across this idea that Sumita puts out there, that Mahan doesn't teach us how to do things today. What Mahan teaches us is how to think about things and how to ask the right questions that we need to answer today that will take us to strategies or operations that will work. So that's kind of where I got started on my reading of Mahan. And then as I read, I discovered that there were some of these works that were more readable than others. Let's be honest, Mahan, writing in the last century, kind of was in desperately need of an editor a lot of the time. He tends to drone on. He himself said in his autobiography that his work suffered from the fact that he felt the need to include every single caveat and yeah, but that he could think of. And so you'll find in a lot of his work that, you know, paragraphs will stretch on for three pages, and he just seems to constantly be taking off in tangents or trying to illustrate points that may not seem central to his book or his article or his chapter or whatever you're reading. So in my reading, I started to find these essays and articles that I thought held together better than some of his other writing, with the idea that, look, the reality is not very many people want to read 600-page tomes these days. So if we can introduce Mahan in smaller bites to people in an approachable way, we can help people learn what the man really thought.
Not exactly the cliff notes, but certainly a bit more abbreviated and tighter and more focused.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it the cliff notes at all. Because the themes of the five essays that are in 21st century Mahan are not the six elements that make up sea power, which is what The Influence of Sea Power Upon History is about. You know, the themes of these five essays are, it's about other things. It's about effective naval leadership. It's about how to run an administrative bureaucracy, which is what a navy really is in many cases. It's about the role of trust in leadership. It's about how to teach officers and sailors and how to train them. These are all themes that run throughout that large oeuvre of work, you know, those 300-plus articles and almost two dozen books. They're themes that run throughout those, but that if you just read The Influence, you're going to miss these themes and these important things to know because he doesn't really write about them in that book.
And at the very end, the very last essay is something called History and Conventional Wisdom. Boy, now there's a loaded title if I've ever heard one.
Yeah, exactly. See, the Mahan that most people are taught about, if just in passing in their history class, or even if you're at the War College and they only have a week or two in your seminar to get through Mahan and Corbett before you have to move on to somebody else, what you get taught is about the importance of the battle fleet, and potentially you get taught a little bit about the American introduction into imperialism. Probably isn't the right word, and colonialism isn't the right word, but into that form of foreign relations that happened at the turn of the last century. And those are important parts of what Mahan wrote about. There's certainly truth in teaching those things. But the last chapter, the brief biography of Edward Pellew, who was a British Royal Navy officer, kind of illustrates the fact that if that's what you've learned about Mahan, that it's all about battleships and colonies, then why is he writing this biography of an officer who was known as a partisan officer and was known as potentially the best frigate skipper in the Royal Navy? Frigate skippers don't necessarily stand in the battle line. Frigate skippers are off on detached missions on their own, conducting naval diplomacy, conducting gunboat diplomacy, conducting counter-piracy operations, those kinds of things. Why would Mahan write about this guy if all he cared about was the ships of the line, the 74s, the big battleships? And it's because the conventional wisdom on Mahan is kind of inaccurate. He cared about a great deal more and wrote about a great deal more than just that.
And as you point out, frigate captains, they're doing counterinsurgency, they're practicing unconventional warfare. They're doing a lot of the missions that we would think of as familiar in this day and age right now, correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, frequently you look at modern naval operations, and they tend to be irregular naval operations, non-traditional. You know, we're not talking about the Blue Water fight. We're talking about counter-piracy. We're talking about, you know, supporting operations ashore, expeditionary operations, things like that. And so the illustration of Pellew is an illustration that Mahan, it's not that he didn't find value in these things. He did. It might not have been the primary focus. You know, you have to start with a strong battle fleet. That is what Mahan believed. And there's absolute truth in that. But just because you have that strong battle fleet doesn't mean that's the only thing you do as a Navy. Mahan also believed in, you know, a balanced force and the ability to do these other things. He wrote about Nelson. He wrote a two-volume biography of Nelson in which he talks about how Nelson, when he was in the Mediterranean and he was the commander of the Royal Navy's forces in the Mediterranean, Nelson wanted to stamp out the Barbary piracy, and he probably could have. The problem is Nelson had a greater mission, and that greater mission was containing the French fleets. And having the Barbary pirates preying on French commerce kind of actually helped him. So even though he wanted to stamp out the Barbary corsairs, he knew that strategically it was the wrong decision to make, and so he didn't. And Mahan agreed with that, and he completely agreed with the idea that piracy is a terrible thing and that navies should fight it. But what he said in the case of Nelson was, look, strategically you have to make a decision here. And Nelson made the right call. The result ended up being that, readers will see in that last chapter, Pellew actually gets to be the commander in the Mediterranean who stamps out Barbary piracy once and for all towards the end of his career. And he actually does it in a international operation, a combined operation. It wasn't just Royal Navy ships. And he does it projecting power ashore, and he does it through bombardment. All things that supposedly Mahan didn't care for or didn't write about, yet he highlights it as important things that Pellew did.
Interesting. Now, as you point out, Mahan died almost simultaneously with the start of the First World War. Some have even said a war to which he was a major contributor because of the buildup of battle fleets worldwide as a result of reading his book. What sort of things came about in World War One that he had projected for navies in not just that book, but his other writings?
Well, I think that one of the things that he frequently gets criticized for is the things actually that he didn't foresee coming out of World War One. You know, people will frequently talk about how the fact that he didn't really write about submarines and how submarines were important. He didn't really write about airplanes, you know, because airplanes obviously coming out of World War One and naval aviation, the introduction thereof, would drive us to how we fought World War Two. And people will say, well, Mahan didn't write about those, and so therefore he couldn't possibly have been thinking about the future, and so why, now that we're in the future, do we need to read him? I think that's an unfair criticism of Mahan. You know, we don't really look to our history because it's predictive of exact things in the future. It's more ideas that we look to it for, kind of like what I talked about before, the asking the right questions sort of thing. Although, I mean, if you think about in World War One, the Battle of the Atlantic, it was all about maintaining the supply lines, not necessarily commerce, but definitely, you know, protecting the supply lines. And the British at Jutland and the keeping of their fleet there to blockade the German high seas fleet prior to the Battle of Jutland was, in reality, a Mahanian strategy. Potentially, it you could look at it as holding back the Battle of the Atlantic, but if the high seas fleet had been able to escape, what happens next? Well, that's the grand question that doesn't have to be answered because the British did follow that classical naval strategy.
And we can hardly hold the man hostage intellectually for systems which really had not even been built at the time. When he was referencing the history of sea power that really was ending about 1815, correct?
That's true, and it's important to also remember that, you know, these historical writers and strategic writers need to be viewed within the context of the time and place that they wrote. The example of Mahan and Corbett is a good one because, like I said, Mahan was writing for a weak power that wanted to become strong. Corbett was writing for an established world hegemon. So, you know, many officers today will say, well, you know, Corbett makes a lot more sense to me than Mahan does. Well, that's because if you're in the U.S. Navy, you are in the dominant Navy. And so the fact that you identify more with Corbett, who is writing for that audience, it makes a lot of sense. It doesn't mean Mahan was wrong. It just means that you need to view it in a different way. You need to read it differently and think about different things. Also, I think it's important to point out that, you know, Mahan, some of the language that Mahan used in much of his writing, especially when he talked about overseas, is language that might be considered racist today. But if that's the way certain peoples were referred to in his time and in his place, I don't know that we should be labeling him as a racist. One of the reviews of my book kind of criticized me for not pointing out what a racist he was. And I don't really know that that's a fair assessment. Whenever we read history, whenever we read books, especially from 100 years ago or more, remembering context is always important.
And let's talk a little bit more about context and the influence of Mahan upon American strategy. Obviously, we came out of World War One repugnant with what had occurred in the Great War over in Europe, other places. And like the rest of the world, we tried to make war unpalatable, ban it, make it illegal, limit it. And of course, 20 years later, we were back at it in Europe with World War Two. How was Mahan influential in the development of American strategy between the wars, And how did his influence extend into the actual campaigns of the U.S. Navy in World War II?
Well, I think looking for, you know, specific examples of influence may be difficult, because in reality, what Mahan provided is a foundation. It's a starting point that says that the interaction between nations kind of requires navies, and we're going to have these sea battles, especially when nations who are separated by oceans, which all true sea powers are. I mean, if you look at the true sea powers in history, you know, Athens separated by water from Persia, from the Persian Empire, Great Britain, obviously an island surrounded by water, you know, Japan, a strong sea power for much of its history, surrounded by water, it's an island, and the United States, to a certain extent, because it runs across an entire continent, also surrounded by water. And so it's this foundational idea is what Mahan provides. Mahan also wrote about the importance of having a balanced fleet and having many different types of ships, you know, so it's actually counterintuitive to the conventional wisdom on him that says, you know, battleships, battleships, battleships. It's the only thing he cared about. He actually wrote in one of the essays in my book, he wrote about a balanced fleet. He wrote about the battle fleet being a part of the force, but not the entire force. The force also needed cruisers. It also needed scouts. It also needed smaller ships that could work inshore in the littorals and work close to harbors. It needed those ships to be able to do scouting as well. And so,
and as you pointed out, it needed infrastructure, a shore-based establishment to support it and keep it supplied and maintained.
Exactly. And that was the crux of the Mahanian ideal of imperialism or colonialism. It wasn't imperialism and colonialism the way that we know it through the history books of, say, England or Germany or some of these other powers that had colonies overseas. What Mahan meant was engagement with overseas locations where you could base fleets, where you could set up coaling stations, where you could set up repair facilities. That's what he was going for. It wasn't about taking over land and controlling it and owning it and having it as part of your country. It was about creating these bases that you could then protect your commerce through. And so the Philippines are an example. When the Spanish-American War, when the United States was victorious, Mahan did not want the Philippines to become part of the United States. In fact, he initially didn't even like the idea of the United States taking over the government in the Philippines. All he thought needed to be done was a naval base installed, and a deal made with the locals, you know, whoever they set up as their government once they were freed from Spain, that our naval base could exist there. It wasn't until he started to see how the reality was playing out on the ground and the possibility that that naval base wasn't going to happen that he grudgingly acceded to this idea of the United States establishing a governorship there in the Philippines.
Now, as we get farther and farther from Mahan, the question arises, he taught us about the importance of navies. He talked about how to build them and maintain them. How does this feed into the idea of a national strategy? Did he actually come out and say, you need a national strategy to be a great power in this world?
Well, he never really explicitly says it quite that clearly. As you'll find with a lot of Mahan, if you read his work, a lot of it is you have to read it and think about what he said. He's not going to be necessarily that clear about things. Mahan wrote about three elements of national power. And we all know the Clausewitz line about how war is an extension of politics by other means. And Mahan wrote about something similar, and he said that war and military action is absolutely a political element, but that interaction which causes war also might be economic. So he wrote about these three elements: the military, the political or diplomatic, and the economic or commercial. And the interaction of these three elements are kind of what govern national strategy in the way that nations interact with each other. I mean, really what it is they govern the way nations interact with each other, and therefore, if that's how nations interact, then those are the elements that need to be part of your national strategy as you develop one.
And as we moved from World War II into the Cold War, these elements do become a big part initially of the Truman Doctrine of containment and the overall Cold War strategy, which stayed in place for, what, the next half century, correct?
I think that's a pretty accurate assessment. You know, historians and political scientists will probably argue one point or another, but they were certainly all considered and an element of the way that the two superpowers interacted with each other.
So we now come to the end of the Cold War. It's 1989. You know, we're partying, the wall's down, whoop whoop, we won. Except we don't have a strategy anymore. Talk a little bit about your perceptions of how America has proceeded in the following 25 years, the generation since the wall fell in 89, and what have we substituted for national strategy? What have we done not really having a single clear way forward?
Well, I'll be honest with you here, John. This is where I'm going to use the disclaimer at the start of our conversation to demur a little bit. As we get closer to the modern day and we start talking about policy decisions that are made by our political leaders in Washington, as a serving naval officer, I'm gonna hold back for a minute or two and maybe not get too deeply into that mix. What I will say is that Mahan believed in having a starting point. Mahan believed in having a strategy, not because it was going to give you a perfect answer. It never did, and he wrote about that, and he recognized that. A strategy is a starting point. It's like Helmut von Moltke the Elder, who was head of the Prussian staff in the 1800s, or in a portion of the 1800s, who first used the phrase, "No plan survives first contact with the enemy." And that's absolutely true. There is no such thing as perfection. And Mahan wrote about it in the essay that's in the second chapter of 21st Century Mahan, when he said, we have to disabuse ourselves of this idea that we're going to come up with a strategy in which we can eliminate all risk. It's not possible. There's going to be risk. The enemy is going to get a vote. And so we're going to have to change and adapt. So that is what I would say, is that Mahan would be a firm supporter of the idea that we have to have a strategy. We have to have a starting point. Deviating from that starting point is part of operating. It's part of doing your job. But this idea that because we don't know what comes next, because we don't know exactly what's going to happen, well, we can't make a strategy for it because we expect our strategy to be perfect, he would fight back against that idea.
Well, and let's take it a little different direction, especially since we don't want to cause you any professional difficulties. If you were talking to quote unquote average Americans who have never even heard of Mahan, and frankly wouldn't know Mahan if they had a case of his books dropped on them, what would you say is the benefit, the big you know, top three or top five benefits of having a national strategy for outreach into the world? How would you explain why it's a good thing?
Well, I think it's kind of like I was saying before, that it's having a starting point. It's having a positive message, something that you're trying to accomplish. simply being reactionary to everything will tend to it'll tend to cause you probably to miss out on opportunities if you're just waiting for things to happen. Having a national strategy is the kind of thing that nations also, it's kind of a responsibility, Mahan would have told people. He would have told people that, you know, the great powers in his time, or if it's a unipolar world, if it's a great power, which we were for a while, and I think other powers are gaining in their strength today, those powers have a certain responsibility to maintain a system, if you will, and how the world works. And it's that responsibility that Mahan thought was part of why a great power needed a strategy, was so that people kind of knew what that power stood for. Now, that can mean many different things. Mahan wrote a great deal about morality and the place for morality in the interaction between nations. And he believed that the United States was different than Great Britain, which he wrote about as kind of his grand example of a sea power and having a strategy that covered the world. You know, he said that the United States was different because the United States was not out to have colonies, was not out to have, you know, possessions, and was not out simply for its own benefit. The ideal, the American ideal, going back to the founders in Mahan's mind, was this idea of raising everybody up, improving the world for everybody. And so you see the ideals of free trade, freedom of navigation, and peacetime, those kinds of things. I say in peacetime because in wartime he had very specific thoughts about the ability to attack another nation's commerce. But in peacetime, he believed those things were a great benefit to all.
And as you say, these are tenets that other men, Teddy Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, Eisenhower, embraced in the, you know, once the so-called big fight of World War II was completed, that now, how do we build a post-imperial world?
Yeah.
A question, and this one comes to, I'm sure, is relevant to you, and we're not going to flirt too hard with it. Mahan topped out as a captain. And in fact, if you look at many of the great strategy and power theorists, they tend to go and top out as colonels and captains, be it John Warden, who wrote the Air Campaign, among others. What is it about the great strategic theorists that they don't seem to become generals and admirals, and yet their names are on the lips of every general and admiral out there?
Well, I think in Mahan's case, if we go back to his actual biography and his actual history, you got to remember that when Mahan was in the Navy, promotions were not done by promotion boards. Promotions were not done through merit. They weren't done through selection. When Mahan was in the Navy, promotion was done strictly based on seniority. You had to wait till someone died or retired for everyone to move up a notch. And so the fact that Mahan didn't actually make admiral until he was made admiral as an honorary title by Congress after he had retired, after the turn of the century, but while in uniform, he never made admiral. That fact is not actually based on negative fit reps, or the fact that people didn't like him, or the fact that people didn't think what he was doing was important or relevant, which there were people who thought all those things. But it was based on the fact that the spot hadn't opened up yet, and the fact that he decided that at a certain point, sticking around and going back to sea and being the commander of another battleship or another ship and deploying again, could he make a greater impact to his country or contribution to his country by doing that, or by retiring from the service, staying home, and continuing to study history and write the things that he was thinking about. And he decided that he thought he could make a greater contribution by staying home and writing about these things. And I think it was probably a wise choice. To be honest, there are some who have written about Mahan and pointed out that he may not have been the best ship handler, and he may not have been the best guy on deployment. He tended to get a little seasick, and he didn't particularly like being at sea very much the older that he got, although that tends to be an occupational hazard for some folks. So that's the reality of Mahan not making admiral, was it really was in that time and place, the context, like I was talking about before, it was about how long you could stick it out and whether or not a whole batch of guys had retired before promotions happened. Although to your larger point, I think it's probably accurate that that generally you have folks that don't necessarily make it to the highest ranks who end up later on being recognized as strategic leaders or thinkers. I think that even today there are probably many who have that same decision to make as what Mahan did, and the question of, do I stay in uniform and keep along this track that gets me promoted, or can I make a greater contribution by retiring and by continuing to contribute to my country outside of wearing the uniform? And so I think a number of folks probably make that decision. You know, John Boyd is probably one of those examples. You know, he was passed over a number of times, but he continued to make a great contribution to military thinking and to strategy after he left the service and wasn't in uniform anymore.
And let's not kid ourselves. We speak his name with reverence now.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Let me ask you this question, and this is one of those don't get Commander Armstrong in trouble, because we know how much 3 and 4 stars love 04s and 05s to speak their mind about strategy and development of the fleet and things like that. But that all said, if Alfred Thayer Mahan could be reincarnated and dropped into our present world here in 2013, and he could actually be on the board making recommendations to develop a new national strategy, what do you think would catch his eye, and what opportunities do you think he would recommend we take advantage of?
Well, I mean, Mahan did actually write about this in his day in a number of essays in the 1890s, I believe, when he wrote about the idea that when he looked at the United States of America and he looked at your average American believed that the Army was more important than the Navy in defending the country. And I think because of 10 years of ground combat in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, I think probably we're in a similar place today. The Navy, because it is overseas, because it is deployed far from home all of the time, may kind of struggle to communicate why it's important to the American people. And Mahan wrote about this idea that, you know, especially in times of peace, the Navy is actually the most important of the services because it's the one that's out there, because it's the one that's interacting with these other countries on a daily basis. Also, Mahan wrote about the idea, and this was very, very true then, and especially in the 19th century, that the diplomatic role of the Navy was very important. Because you have to remember back then, we didn't necessarily have an embassy in every country. We didn't necessarily have State Department representation everywhere. And so in many places, a naval ship would show up, and that captain would be the senior diplomatic person in that country. If you think about it, during the 19th century, a large number of our country's first economic or political treaties were negotiated by naval officers, you know, Perry in Japan or in Korea or in a number of other places. So I think Mahan, looking at today, would look at the roughly equal budget slices that exist for the different military services, and he would say that we probably need to look at that strategically. We probably shouldn't look at this as an admin drill where we try and make everybody happy. We need to look at this strategically. Now, me personally, I'm not going to prejudge that. I mean, a true strategic look may decide that the Air Force today is the most important service to have a slice of the pie, if you will. You know, we all know what Mahan would have said and which service he would have picked. But I think his overall idea that you need to look at these decisions about spending money on defense in a strategic way, because even he recognized, I think it was the phrase was, it's an onerous money question to prepare a nation's military. And choices have to be made. And he wrote about how choices must be made because the money is not unlimited. And so I think that would be the biggest thing that he would notice today is the idea that, hey, strategic choices have to be made. And that's the way that a properly prepared nation or how a nation goes about becoming properly prepared for the future.
Commander, I don't think we could finish this discussion on a better ending than you just gave us. Thank you. And I'd like to ask you a couple of other questions about yourself. Obviously, where are you headed and what's your next writing projects look like?
So right now I'm actually a research student with the War Studies Department with King's College London. And I'm working on a thesis that examines the Age of Sail United States Navy and that Navy's role in what today we would call maritime irregular warfare. So basically your non-blue water missions, your non-squadron-on-squadron, non-ship-on-ship, you know, frigate duel type operations. So cutting out expeditions, expeditionary raids, counter-piracy operations. You know, how were these types of missions conducted in the first couple decades of the United States Navy? And is there anything we can learn from the way that they were conducted back then that might be applicable to today? So that's kind of my ongoing research. And you can see some writing that I've done on it. The most recent issue of Naval History Magazine contains an article that I wrote about cutting out expeditions in the War of 1812 on the Great Lakes. And so that's the kind of historical research that I'm focused on right now.
Very good. I imagine you're going to spend some time looking at the records of incidents in North Africa as well.
Yep. Yeah. And in fact, back in 2010, the Naval War College Review published an article that I wrote about the raid on Tripoli Harbor to burn the Philadelphia, with the same kind of idea in mind. Hey, here's the history, and can we learn anything from it that we might be able to apply today?
And professionally, what are your plans? Are you going to be staying in the Navy, or are you going to be working towards what's your next assignment look like?
I'm a helicopter pilot by trade, so I am anxiously awaiting the coming months and years when the next rounds of promotion boards, selection boards announce their results, that kind of thing. So my hope is to head back to a helicopter squadron and get another chance to fly. And if that doesn't play out, we'll see where the road takes me.
Are you, as a side note, are you ready to have a helicopter squadron where you may have to also have aircraft that don't even have men in them, things like the Fire Scout and Fire X that may be coming online if you get a command tour?
I have to tell you, absolutely, and I've written about this before in a number of places, including in the journal Rotor Review, which is the Naval Helicopter Association's journal. I think unmanned aviation is an important part of our future, and as aviators, we need to embrace it, because if we don't embrace it, that means someone else is going to make the decisions and someone else is going to control it, someone who doesn't actually have air sense, if you will. And so I think it's very important that we get on board with the unmanned future. It's happening. There's no way around it. So making sure that it's effective, that it's operational, that it tactically works, is going to require our engagement and our deep thinking. And so, absolutely, I think that that's an important part of our future.
One last question, and I'll let you go. You are part of a new generation of officer writers that has grown up in the shadow of some great, great names like Elmo Zumwalt and Jim Stravitis. If you can reach out and talk to naval officers and Marine Corps officers and just officers of all the services, give them a reason to write. Tell them why you think they ought to be writing and writing professionally.
So I've talked about this with a number of folks, and I've actually written about it in the pages of Proceedings. There's two reasons why I think people should be writing. The first one is I see it as a professional responsibility. If you have an idea that you think is really good or that can help us make us better at what we do, it's a professional responsibility to get that idea out there. The fact that in the process of writing an article, you're going to refine that thinking, you're going to do more research on that thinking, you're going to figure out a better way to describe it, you're going to figure out a better way to support it, you're going to be able to argue your point. All important elements of communication, and communication is the heart of leadership. So I think it does two things. One, by writing and publishing, you're going to make the service better, whatever that service may be, whether it's the Navy or the Marine Corps or the Army or the Air Force or the Coast Guard. You're going to make your service better. You're also going to make yourself a better communicator and a stronger leader through the process. So there's kind of two reasons to do it there.
Very good. Commander, I want to thank you for coming on today, giving us a piece of your mind, actually a couple of pieces, and I hope we'll have a chance to talk to you again soon. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, John. I appreciate you and your listeners taking the time to talk with me.
Back to work with you, sir. You got things waiting back for you in the Secretary's office.
Thanks so much.
Take care. And with that, I want to thank all of our listeners for coming in and giving us another listen on Military Monday. We'll be back again next week at 1 p.m., and I can promise you we will have an interesting show. We're just making up our mind which one to go with right now. And as we go and close this show, keep your eye on Kenya and the victims of the terrorist attack in Nairobi. That is going to be a big story that we are going to have major repercussions from, and we undoubtedly will be talking about here in future editions of Military Monday. Have a great week ahead. Be safe. Take care.